Chapter 2. The Making of Sirius. Plax's father, Thomas Trelone, was too great a scientist to escape all publicity, but his work on the stimulation of cortical growth in the brains of mammals was begun while he was merely a brilliant young research worker, and it was subsequently carried on in strict secrecy. He had an exaggerated, a morbid loathing of limelight. This obsession he justified by explaining that he dreaded the exploitation of his technique by quacks and profit-mongers. Thus it was that for many years his experiments were known only to a few of his most intimate professional colleagues in Cambridge, and to his wife, who had a part to play in them. Though I've seen his records and read his papers, I can give only a layman's account of his work, for I am without scientific training. By introducing a certain hormone into the bloodstream of the mother, he could affect the growth of the brain in the unborn young. The hormone apparently had a double effect. It increased the actual bulk of the cerebral cortices, and also it made the nerve fibres themselves much finer than they normally are, so that a far greater number of them and a far greater number of connections between them occurred in any given volume of brain. Somewhat similar experiments, I believe, were carried out in America by Zamenhof. But there was an important difference between the two techniques. Zamenhof simply fed the young animal with his hormone. Trelone's, as I have said, introduced this hormone into the fetus through the mother's bloodstream. This in itself was a notable achievement, because the circulatory systems of mother and fetus are fairly well insulated from each other by a filtering membrane. One of Trelone's difficulties was that the hormone caused growth in the maternal as well as the fetal brain, and since the mother's skull was adult and rigid, there must inevitably be very serious congestion, which would lead to death, unless some means were found to insulate her brain from the stimulating drug. This difficulty was eventually overcome. At last it became possible to assure the unborn animal a healthy maternal environment. After its birth, Trelone periodically added doses of the hormone to its food, gradually reducing the dose as the growing brain approached what he considered a safe maximum size. He'd also devised a technique for delaying the closure of the sutures between the bones of the skull so that the skull might continue to expand as required. A large population of rats and mice was sacrificed in the attempt to perfect Trelone's technique. At last he was able to produce a number of remarkable creatures. His big-headed rats, mice, guinea pigs, rabbits, though their health was generally bad, and their lives were nearly always cut short by disease of one kind or another, were certainly geniuses of their humble order. They were remarkably quick at finding their way through mazes and so on. In fact, they far excelled their species in all the common tests of animal intelligence, and had the mentality rather of dogs and apes than of rodents. But this was for Trelone only the beginning. While he was improving his technique, so that he could ensure a rather more healthy animal, he at the same time undertook research into methods of altering the tempo of its life so that it should mature very slowly and live much longer than was normal to its kind. Obviously, this was very important. A bigger brain needs a longer lifetime to fulfill its greater potentiality for amassing and assimilating experience. Not until he had made satisfactory progress in both these enterprises did he begin to experiment on animals of greater size and higher type. This was a much more formidable undertaking and promised no quick results. After a few years, he had produced a number of clever but seedy cats, a bright monkey that died during its protracted adolescence, and a dog with so big a brain that its crushed and useless eyes were pushed forward along its nose. This creature suffered so much that its producer reluctantly destroyed it in infancy. Not till several more years had elapsed had Trelone perfected his technique to such an extent that he was able to pay less attention to the physiological and more to the psychological aspect of his problem. Contrary to his original plan, he worked henceforth mainly on dogs, rather than apes. Of course, apes offered the hope of more spectacular success. They were by nature better equipped than dogs. Their brains were bigger, their sight was more developed, and they had hands. Nevertheless, from Trelawne's point of view, dogs had one overwhelming advantage. They were capable of a much greater freedom of movement in our society. Trelawne confessed that he would have preferred to work on cats because of their more independent mentality, but their small size made them unsuitable. A certain absolute bulk of brain was necessary, no matter what the size of the animal, so as to afford a wealth of associative neural paths. Of course, a small animal did not need as large a brain as a large animal of the same mental rank. A large body needed a correspondingly large brain merely to work its machinery. A lion's brain had to be bigger than a cat's. An elephant's brain was even larger than a much more intelligent but smaller man's. On the other hand, each rank of intelligence, no matter what the size of the animal, required a certain degree of complexity of neural organization, and so of brain bulk. In proportion to the size of the human body, a man's brain was far bigger than an elephant's. Some animals were large enough to accommodate the absolute bulk of brain needed for the human order of intelligence, some were not. A large dog could easily do so. But a cat's organization would be very gravely upset by so great an addition. For a mouse, anything of the sort would be impossible. Not that Trelawne had, at this stage, any expectation of raising any animal so far in mental stature that it would approach human mentality. His aim was merely to produce, as he put it, a rather super-subhuman intelligence, a missing link mind. For this purpose, the dog was admirably suited. Human society afforded for dogs many vocations requiring intelligence at the upper limit of the subhuman range. Trelawne chose as the best vocation of all for his purpose that of the sheepdog. His acknowledged ambition was to produce a super sheepdog. One other consideration inclined him to choose the dog, and the fact that he took this point into account at all in the early stage of his work shows that he was even then toying with the idea of producing something more than a missing link mind. He regarded the dog's temperament as on the whole more capable of development to the human level. If cats excelled in independence, dogs excelled in social awareness, and Trelawne argued that only the social animal could make full use of its intelligence. The independence of the cat was not, after all, the independence of the socially aware creature asserting its individuality. It was merely the blind individualism that resulted from social obtuseness. On the other hand, he admitted that the dog's sociality involved it, in relation to man, in abject servility, but he hoped that with increased intelligence it might gain a measure of self-respect and of critical detachment from humanity. In due course, Trelawne succeeded in producing a litter of big-brained puppies. Most of them died before reaching maturity, but two survived and became exceptionally bright dogs. This result was on the whole less gratifying than disappointing to Trelawne. He carried out further experiments, and at last, from an old English sheepdog bitch, produced a big-brained family, three of which survived and reached a definitely super-canine level of mentality. The research continued for some years. Trelawne found it necessary to take more trouble about the raw material to which his technique was to be applied. He could not afford to neglect the fact that the most capable of all the canine races is the Border Collie, bred through a couple of centuries for intelligence and responsibility. All modern champions are of this breed, and all are descendants of a certain brilliant animal named Old Hemp, who was born in Northumberland in 1893. The Border Collie of today is hardy but rather small. Trelawne, therefore, decided that the best raw material would be a cross between some outstanding champion of the international sheepdog trials and another intelligent but much heavier animal. The Alsatian was the obvious choice. After a good deal of negotiation with owners of champion sheepdogs and enthusiasts for Alsatians, he produced several strains, which blended the two types in various proportions. He then applied his improved technique to various expectant mothers of these types, and in due season he was able to provide several of his friends with animals of almost missing-link intelligence as house dogs. But there was nothing spectacular about these creatures, and unfortunately all were delicate, and all died before their somewhat protracted adolescence was completed. But at last, further improvements in his technique brought him real success. He achieved several very bright animals with normally strong constitutions, predominantly Alsatian in appearance. He had persuaded his wife Elizabeth that if ever he succeeded to this extent, they should take a house in a sheep district in Wales. There she and the three children and the forthcoming baby would live, and he himself would spend the vacations and weekends. After much exploration, they found a suitable old farmhouse not far from Trusfernuth. Its name was Garth. A good deal of work had to be done to turn it into a comfortable family home. Water closets and a bathroom had to be installed. Some of the windows were enlarged. Electricity was laid on from the village. An outhouse was converted into a palatial kennel. Sometime after the fourth baby had been born, the family moved. They were accompanied by Kate, the long-established servant, who had somehow become practically a member of the family. A village girl was engaged as her assistant. There was also a nursemaid, Mildred, and, of course, the children, Thomasina, Maurice, Giles, and the baby, Plaxy. Thomas took with him two canine families. One consisted of a bitch and four hardy little animals that he intended to train as super sheepdogs. The other family of four were orphans, the mother having died in giving birth to them. They had, therefore, to be hand-nursed. The brains of these animals were very much bigger than the brains of the other family, but unfortunately three of them were much less healthy. Two died shortly after the removal to Wales. Another was subject to such violent fits that it had to be destroyed. The fourth, Sirius, was a healthy and cheerful little creature that remained a helpless infant long after the other litter were active adolescents. For months it could not even stand. It merely lay on its stomach with its bulgy head on the ground, squeaking for sheer joy of life, for its tail was constantly wagging. Even the other litter matured very slowly for dogs, though far more rapidly than human children. When they were nearly adult, all but one of them was disposed of to neighbouring farms. The one was kept as the family dog. Most of the local farmers had proved very reluctant to take on these big-headed animals even as gifts. But a neighbour, Mr. Llewellyn Pugh of Caer Bligh, had entered into the spirit of the venture, and he subsequently bought a second pup as a colleague for the first. The production of these super sheepdogs and others which followed formed a camouflage for Thomas's more exciting venture, of which Sirius was at present the only outcome. The public would be led to believe that super sheepdogs and other animals of missing-link mentality were his whole concern. If the little Alsatian really developed to human mental stature, few people would suspect it. Thomas was always morbidly anxious that it should not be exploited. It must grow up in decent obscurity and mature as naturally as possible. The super sheepdogs, on the other hand, were allowed to gain notoriety. The farmers, who had accepted them mostly with great reluctance, soon found that fate had given them pearls of great price. The animals learned their technique surprisingly quickly and carried out their orders with unfailing precision. Commands had seldom to be repeated, sheep were never hustled, and yet never allowed to break away. Not only so, but Trelawne's dogs had an uncanny way of understanding instructions and carrying them out with no human supervision. They attach the right meanings to the names of particular pastures, hillsides, valleys, moors. Told to fetch sheep from Theffen, or from Moelvac, or what not, they succeeded in doing so while their master awaited them at home. They could also be sent on errands to neighbouring farms or villages. They would take a basket and a note to a particular shop and bring back the required meat or haberdashery. All this was very useful to the farmers and extremely interesting to Trelone, who was, of course, allowed every chance of studying the animals. He found in them a startlingly high degree of practical inventiveness and a rudimentary but remarkable understanding of language. Being, after all, subhuman, they could not understand speech as we do, but they were incomparably more sensitive than ordinary dogs to familiar words and phrases. Fetch wood from shed, take basket to butcher and baker, and all such simple familiar orders could be distinguished and obeyed, as a rule, without distraction. Thomas wrote a monograph on his super sheepdogs, and consequently scientists from all over the world used to turn up at Garth to be shown the animals at work. Throughout the district their fame was fully established among farmers, and there were many demands for puppies. Very few could be supplied. Some farmers refused to believe that the offspring of these bright animals would not inherit their parents' powers. Naturally, all attempts to breed super sheepdogs from super sheepdogs without the introduction of the hormone into the mother were a complete failure. But it is time to return to the little Alsatian, in fact, to Sirius. Trelone was from the first very excited about this animal. The longer it remained a helpless infant, the more excited he became. He saw in it the possibility of the fulfilment of his almost wildest hopes. Discussing it with Elizabeth, he fired her imagination with the prospects of this canine infant and unfolded his plan before her. The animal must have, as far as possible, the same kind of psychological environment as their own baby. He told her of an American animal psychologist and his wife who had brought up a baby chimpanzee in precisely the same conditions as their own little girl. It was fed, clothed, cared for exactly as the child, and with very interesting results. This, Trelone said, was not quite what he wanted for little Sirius, because one could not treat a puppy precisely as a baby without violating its nature. Its bodily organization was too different from the baby's, but what he did want was that Sirius should be brought up to feel himself the social equal of little Plaxy. Differences of treatment must never suggest differences of biological or social rank. Elizabeth had already, he said, proved herself an ideal mother, giving the children that precious feeling of being devotedly loved by a divinely wise and generous being, yet fostering their independence and making no greedy emotional claims on them. This was the atmosphere that Thomas demanded for Sirius, this and the family environment. And their family, he told her, had taught him a very important truth. Unfortunate experiences in his own childhood had led him to regard family as a hopelessly bad institution, and one which ought to be abolished. She would remember his wild ideas of experimenting with her own children. She had tactfully and triumphantly resisted every attempt to remove her own first two children from her. And, before the third was born, Thomas was already convinced that a really good family environment was the right influence for a growing child. No doubt she had made mistakes. Certainly he had made many. No doubt they had to some extent unwittingly damaged their children. There was Tamsie's occasional mulishness and Maurice's diffidence. But on the whole, well, it would be false modesty and unfair to the children not to recognise that they were all three fine specimens, friendly, responsible, yet independent and critical. This was the ideal social tradition in which to perform the great experiment with baby Sirius. Dogs, Thomas reminded Elizabeth, were prone to servility. But this vice was probably not due to something servile in their nature. It sprang from the fact that their great social sensitivity was forced to take a servile turn by the tyranny of the more developed species which controlled them. A dog with human intelligence, brought up to respect itself, would probably not be servile at all, and might quite well develop a superhuman gift for true social relationship. Elizabeth took some time to consider her husband's suggestion, for the responsibility would be mainly hers. Moreover, she was naturally anxious about the effects of the experiment on her own baby. Would her little Plaxy suffer in any way? Thomas persuaded her that no harm would be done, and indeed that the companion of child and supercanine dog must be beneficial to both. With fervour he insisted that the most valuable social relationships were those between minds as different from one another as possible, yet capable of mutual sympathy. It is perhaps remarkable that Thomas, who was not himself gifted with outstanding personal insight or sympathy, should have seen intellectually the essential nature of community. It would be very interesting, he said, to watch the growth of this difficult but pregnant companionship. Of course, it might never develop. There might be mere antagonism. Certainly Elizabeth would have to exercise great tact to prevent the child from overpowering the dog with its many human advantages. In particular, the little girl's hands and more subtle eyesight would be assets which the puppy could never attain. And the whole human environment, which was inevitably alien and awkward for the dog, might well breed neurosis in a mind that was not human, but humanly sensitive. Everything possible must be done to prevent Sirius from becoming either unduly submissive or defiantly arrogant, in the manner so familiar in human beings suffering from a sense of inferiority. One other principle Thomas wanted Elizabeth to bear in mind. It was, of course, impossible to know beforehand how the dog's nature would develop. Sirius might, after all, never reach anything like human mental stature. But everything must be done on the assumption that he would do so. Hence it was very important to bring him up not as a pet, but as a person, as an individual who would in due season live an active and independent life. This being so, his special powers must be fostered. While he was still, as Thomas put it, a schoolboy, his interests would of course be schoolboy interests, physical, primitive, barbarian. But being a dog, his expression of them would necessarily be very different from a real schoolboy's. He would have to exercise them in normal canine occupations, such as desultory roaming and hunting and fighting. But later, as his intelligence opened up the human world to him, he would want some kind of persistent human activity, and obviously sheep could provide him with a career, even if he far excelled the typical super-sheepdog mentality. With this in view, and whatever his destiny, he must be brought up as hard as nails and fit as hell. This had always been Elizabeth's policy with her own children, but Sirius would sometime need to face up to conditions far more Spartan than those of the most Spartan human family. It would not do simply to force him into such conditions. Somehow she must wile him into wanting them, for sheer pride in his own nature, and later for the sake of his work. This, of course, would not apply to his childhood, but in adolescence he must begin of his own free will to seek hardness. Later still, when his mind was no longer juvenile, he would perhaps drop the sheepdog career entirely and give his mind to more adult pursuits. Even so, the hard, practical life of his youth would not have been in vain. It would endow him with permanent grit and self-reliance. Elizabeth was a good deal more sceptical than her husband about the future of Sirius. She expressed a fear, which did not trouble Thomas, that such a disunited being as Sirius might be doomed to a life of mental torture. Nevertheless, she finally made up her mind to enter into the spirit of the experiment, and she planned accordingly.